Yes, I'm credited as a production coordinator on the film, but I did a little bit of everything from voiceover to even some caring roles at times with Shane, and kind of keeping the talent happy and making sure shoots and filming ran as smoothly as possible. But that was easier said than done.
I bet you. Well, when I spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, you said to me it's the most difficult thing you've ever been involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. And Julian has also said in a number of interviews that it's the most, it was the trickiest film he's ever had to make. And I mean he's worked with the likes of the Sex Pistols and the Kinks and some really precarious characters. So he went into it, I suppose, Julian did, expecting it to be tricky, but maybe not as tricky as it turned out.
So just talk us through what you mean by tricky.
I mean, at the beginning, it was kind of waiting around for a while to get the funding together. And then once the funding was there, Julian had all these great, weird and wonderful, ambitious ideas for what we could do. And, some of that included, go flying to San Francisco and doing interviews with Tom Waits and flying to New Zealand or Sydney to interview, Nick Cave, and grand ambitions. But looking back, even though you've got the money to do those things, if the main subject of the documentary, I suppose, is not willing to take part, it is naturally going to be difficult. So we didn't have Shane's full backing at the start, even though, as far as I'm aware, he was the one who reached out to Julian and expressed an interest in wanting a documentary to be made about his life. I don't think one had ever really been made. There was one called The Great Hunger, which was made, I think, in 1997, which was the last time Shane released an album, I believe. And since then, I think there was a Sky Arts documentary that followed Shane having his teeth repaired in Portugal, I believe. I think it was all about him having this dental transformation. So a film, like an all-encompassing sort of life story, hadn't been made of Shane. And Julian and Shane have known each other since they were about 16. There's not much of an age gap between them, and they would have, known each other from kind of the punk circuit in the 70s around London. And they're both public schoolboys as well. Julian studied at Cambridge and Shane went to Westminster School. So they were kind of walking contradictions in a way. They were both going to the Sex Pistols gigs and going to Clash gigs and acting up the punk image. But at the same time, they both came from relatively privileged backgrounds. So they had that in common, but they didn't always see eye to eye. So as well as being a production coordinator, I also acted as mediator along with Johnny's assistant, who was also one of the producers on the film. There was a lot of mediating between Shane and the team. And for anyone who has watched the documentary, I think 5 minutes in, you can hear Shane demanding that I put a record on. I'm behind the camera with Julian, and Shane demands for some Northern Soul and Motown to be put on in the middle of the shoot. And I very politely say to him, I'll put some music on, after we've wrapped up filming. And he snaps at me and says, "If you don't put a, can I swear in this, Mick?"
Yes, it's
Okay.
appropriate, I think.
Okay. Shane snaps at me and says, "If you don't put a record on now, I'm not saying another fucking word." And I mean, you could just see the aggression in his face, and that was just a little snippet of what we had to put up with during production.
That must be very difficult to deal with regularly. I was going to ask you, Siobhan, whether that was a one-off or whether that was par for the course, but I think you've answered that question, haven't you?
Well, I think he was having a particularly bad day that day. I mean, in fairness to Shane, you know, it's not that easy for him to get around these days. Sadly, he's wheelchair bound, and you know, he must be in a lot of pain, and he's also still quite dependent on alcohol. You know, it's not easy to get him on planes and trains and cars and whatnot. So one minute I would be making sure that the camera crew turned up and everybody had what they needed, and next minute I'd be making sure we had wheelchair accessible sort of transport arranged for Shane, and he had everything he needed to be able to move around comfortably. And whether that was making sure there was an appropriate armchair at the location or whatever it might be, all these little things, you know, and it was a lot to think of. It was a lot to think about. There were also times when the softer, kinder and soulful and gentle side would come out of Shane. And often that was when the camera was not rolling. He does like to promote this image of being a bit of a hellraiser, and he'd probably be a bit embarrassed to admit that actually he's a very caring and thoughtful and generous person as well. And he's softer than what you would imagine from having watched interviews. But I suppose all you have to do is listen to the songs and you realize that there is a lot of feeling in those songs, and he expresses his emotions in the most beautiful way through his lyrics. And
his sister Siobhan says his vulnerabilities are masked by his aggression and exacerbated by the drink and drugs. Is that something you'd agree with?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he would only play up when either the cameras were rolling or there was a lot of people on set. And, you know, the majority of the filming was done in 2019, so pre-COVID. So we were able to have a full crew and everything. But it was those moments where you got him alone where, I suppose, his true self would come out. He's a very sensitive person, and he's had a lot of tragedy in his life as well. I mean, he only lost his mother, Therese, I think 3 or 4 years ago. She sadly died very suddenly on New Year's Day in a car crash in Tipperary. And I think that really hit Shane in a big way. And it's since then that he's gone on to marry his partner of 30 plus years, Victoria Mary Clark. And, you know, there's been the 60th birthday celebrations, which took place in January 2018. I think it was kind of a mixture of these things that made Shane attracted to the idea of Julian making this film, because you know, for many years people have said, oh, you know, he'll only live another few years. But I wouldn't be surprised if he outlives us all, because he might be struggling physically, but he's very lucid, very erudite, you know, totally, totally with it, for want of a better term. I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that man's brain or his memory. I mean, he likes to exaggerate stories, of course. I mean, you know, you'll see in the film there's stories of him, you know, eating Beach Boys records and painting himself blue in hotel rooms, and really kind of wild stories of drug taking. And you would wonder, you know, what's fantasy and what's reality. And it's an interesting look into his world and into his mind. But he's very, very much with it, and often it will take him, you know, maybe 30 seconds to answer a question, and you'll think he either hasn't heard you or he hasn't listened to you, but then he will surprise you massively, because he is picking up absolutely everything. He's very, very observant, very, very good at kind of taking in what's happening around him, despite his disabilities.
Have you had any feedback from him about the documentary? Does he like it? Does he not like it?
I haven't had any feedback from Shane, but from what I've heard, he approves of it. At the end of the film, he the message to the audience that, you know, he apologizes because he was talking from the heart. If anyone's to blame for it going wrong, it's Julian, you know. I think he said it could be a total fuck up, you know, because Julian's made it or something like that. That was, you know, there was a, that was kind of the general attitude on set was, Julian had a hard time, I think. Out of all of us, I think Julian had the hardest time when it came to Shane. I was lucky in that Shane took a shining to me, I suppose, for whatever reason. I think with me being kind of the younger one working on the film and also just having a genuine and keen interest in his music. I mean, there was one stage where he was refusing to come to the location to film. And because at that particular time, you know, I was seen as kind of one of the members of the team that he would, I suppose, have a bit of time for. I was, you know, taxied from Kildare to Balls Bridge in Dublin, where he lives, with the mission to kind of coax him out of his house to come down for this shoot that we had planned. You know, we'd gone to a lot of trouble of setting up this beautiful shoot, and it was actually at the Marina Guinness's house, Marina Guinness of the Guinness family, the gorgeous house out in Kildare, and we had a fire lit and a big campfire, and you know, we had musicians there and everything looked beautiful, and all we needed was for Shane to turn up, and he'd promised he would come, and we'd organized transport and everything, and I was then sent with one of the producers to kind of go over to Shane's house and try and convince him really to get into the van and come to the location. And I must have been in the house for well over an hour, even though I failed in my mission. I mean, I left the house without Shane. We still had the most wonderful chats, and fair play to his wife, Victoria, because little did I know she had set up a video. She had been filming it, the whole encounter, on her iPhone, and she later WhatsApped it to me, and it's of me and Shane having this discussion about the music of Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy. I know some people would say Phil Lynott, but for the purpose of this call, I'm going to say Phil Lynott, because many Irish people would still pronounce it Lynott, even though the man himself would say Lynott. And we were talking about the early Lizzy records, in particular, you know, their debut album and then Shades of a Blue Orphanage. And I've got that album cover or the logo tattooed on my wrist. So I was showing that to Shane, and he just broke out into song, and he started singing Little Girl in Bloom to me. And he remembered every lyric word for word, like word perfect. And he then took out his wrist and showed me this chain that he was wearing. And lo and behold, it was Phil Lynott's chain. It's the one he wears, I think, on the cover of Live and Dangerous.
Wow.
And Phil Lynott had gifted that to Shane. And that was a really special moment for me, because I'm a huge Thin Lizzy fan and a huge Shane fan. And kind of these two worlds colliding, and I didn't know that the camera was rolling at the time, but and I don't know if I'll ever post that video, but I will cherish it forever, because it shows the real Shane. You know, he was so kind and warm and kind of giving with his time, you know, a generosity of spirit. You know, you hear this phrase, but that kind of sums him up. Like, he's very generous when it comes to teaching people things, and he loves discussing, you know, Irish history, Irish music, books, you know, he's a big fan of nature documentaries, for instance. You know, he has lots of interests, and if you get him on his own, he's more likely to be himself, I suppose, like many of us. And then when you're surrounded by crew and fellow celebrities, the bravado and the ego come out. So it was there was definitely two personalities we were kind of grappling with. It was like, oh, what version of Shane are we going to get today? More often than not, when the camera was rolling, he would revert back to being the difficult, drunk punk that we all know and love.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me, maybe I'm misreading you, it sounds to me that there's a slight hint of regret in your voice that you didn't get more of what he's really like out on film. Or are you saying really that it was impossible to do that because of the infrastructure?
Well, I think Julian did manage to do it, but in a beautifully kind of subtle way. You know, there are moments in the film where Julian's use of kind of just very simple camera work, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, sat in an empty pub contemplating life or contemplating whatever, or maybe he's just thinking what he's going to have for dinner that evening. I don't know, but there's a sadness in his eyes and there's a sadness on his face. And I think Shane does have a lot of regrets, but I also think he's very proud of everything that he has achieved. And I think Julian managed to capture some of that truth at times yes. in the film. You know, it is really a journey, the whole film. I mean, there's so many ups and downs. I mean, from one minute, it's like, the release of Fairy Tale of New York and the whole band are on such a high from this massive hit, and you know they're traveling the world, and then next minute Shane drops out of the tour and he goes on a binge and he ends up having to go to hospital and to recover. And I think you mentioned his sister Siobhan. I mean, she was, in my opinion, one of the best interviews that we got, because she was so honest and she gave us a real insight into what Shane is like, not just from his childhood, but even now today. You know, he can be a difficult person. I mean, for instance, there was a shoot that we had planned in the September of 2019 in Tipperary. At his family home, the Commons it's called, and he made it as far as like the local town and decided he was going to stop into the pub for a pint, and his 93-year-old father, you know, managed to make it from Dublin to Tipperary and was all set up and ready to film with us, and Shane just refused to leave the pub. And I actually wasn't there yet. I was due to fly out from London and I got a phone call from one of the producers to say, it's not happening. Don't even bother getting on the plane because Shane's not turned up and it's unlikely that this is going to happen. So that particular shoot didn't happen in the way we had planned, but there is a snippet from it where he sat in that pub and his dad is sat beside him and his dad kind of, you know, tells him off a little bit, like he's still a young lad, and kind of, you know, quite rightly in my opinion, tells him, you know, you can't be treating people like this, and you know, you promised to do this and you must cooperate, but you know, God help you if you try and tell Shane McGowan what to do. I've learned that the hard way. So a lot of it really was mediating, making sure that Shane was happy, that Johnny was happy, that our interviewers and interviewees all turned up and were looked after, and that Julian was okay, because he would have had an idea in his head how things were going to go. But I think any filmmaker would understand when I say you go into a project thinking this is how it's going to be and this is how it's going to turn out, and it very rarely goes the way that you plan for things to go. And that was the case with this film, but I don't think that had an effect at all on what we got out as the finished product in the end. I think Julian did a fantastic job in kind of navigating around those difficulties, and whether that was through the use of archive, which he's famous for, you know, his use of archive is beautiful. And also animation as well. We had the likes of Ralph Steadman do some of the animations for us. And some of those I did voiceover for as well. So you might notice a school nun, the drunken lady on the streets of London, and Shane's mum. Quite a few of those voiceovers were done by me. And that was great fun, you know. So
yeah,
it was a real mixture.
I bet you. I mean, were people treading on eggshells around him all the time, or was it only just some of the time?
Not all the time. At the beginning, I wasn't treading on any eggshells, but then there was moments where, you know, he could really snap at you and upset you. And I'm proud to say, I think I only cried once during production, and it wasn't because of anything Shane said. I think it was because he didn't turn up for something, and we'd just gone to a lot of trouble to set up one particular shoot. I think actually it was that day where I was sent up to try and coax him out of the house. And I think it was mostly just exhaustion, you know. But no, there wasn't many treading on eggshells. Shane has a respect for people who are quite forthright, and, you know, he can sniff out bullshit as well. He can tell when people are just sucking up to him, and he doesn't have much respect for that either. We also, you know, we Julian had the idea then that the best way around Shane's kind of adversity to interviews would be to get people that he respected to do the interviews. And some of those were Johnny Depp, who was executive producer, and Bobby Gillespie from Primal Scream, Shane's biographer, Anne Scanlon, people you would expect him to be quite respectful to. But he even has a go at poor Bobby Gillespie. You know, there's Bobby trying to get, you know, Julian had said to Bobby, you know, try and get him to talk about first coming to London. And
he wasn't having that, was he?
No. And this is one of the things that was quite noticeable. And I suppose any Shane fans or Pogues fans would have noticed that Shane kind of tiptoes around his earlier years, because he likes to, I suppose, hide the fact that he was born in Kent and he went to Westminster School, and he used to turn up to Sex Pistols gigs wearing Union Jacks, you know.
Yes, I've seen, I mean, there's many photos from the 70s of him in a big Union Jack t-shirt.
He led us to sort of believe that he spent the first 6 years of his life in Ireland. It wasn't until we were walking up the path to his grandparents' house, and I was, you know, walking along the path with his sister Siobhan, and I just turned to her and said, so from what age did Shane live here? And she turned to me and said, oh, Shane never lived here. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not looking forward to telling this to Julian. Because we had been led to believe that Shane grew up there for the first 6 years of his life. And that is the story that he, you know, would like to put out to the world. And it's kind of sad, really, when you think about it, that he is a bit embarrassed, I suppose. Well, this is just my opinion. You know, I think he's always identified more as an Irish man, but he actually only spent his summers in Ireland. But who am I to say, you know, how Irish he is? Because in my opinion, you're as Irish as you feel.
Yes.
He absolutely 100% identifies as an Irish man, a proud Irish man. And he shies away from talking about those early years, I think, because, you know, many, you know, second generation Irish people in England would have very fond memories of spending their summers in Ireland with their grandparents. You know, my mother, for instance, you know, she would have very fond memories of spending time with her father's people in Ballinasloe and with her mother's people in Swinford. And she moved back, you know, when I was 2 years old and she was still in her 20s. And my dad spent 30 years in Manchester, but he always wanted to come back to Ireland. And that was where Shane's heart was. His heart was in Tipperary. He identifies as a Tipperary man, despite his London Irish accent. He had to kind of tiptoe around certain things with him. And those early years were were definitely an area that he would rather avoid.
That did come over, I feel, Siobhan.
I do have a lot of fond memories of that film. I mean, yeah, it didn't quite turn out to be the film that Julian had set out to make, but having read the reviews and seeing the awards that we've won over the last year or so, I mean, something I'm very proud to be part of. The reviews have been unbelievable, and you know, it's an experience that I'll never forget. And even working with somebody like Johnny Depp, whose films I would have grown up with, you know, Edward Scissorhands, and
yes,
and getting to know them a little bit, like, what a privilege and a pleasure. it was just brilliant.
Brilliant. Thanks, Siobhan. Appreciate that. That was great. That's a nice way to end that, I think.